alcoholic. And I know you're getting tired of sitting, but we gave you a little extra time to get up and plow around a little bit, so maybe that revives some of you. If you still won't take a nap, feel free. Just, I won't embarrass you in public, except there's one fella who told me he was going to take a nap, and I'll embarrass him, but not anybody else. Okay, let's get into our step three, but first I'm going to backtrack for the principle on step two that I have on my little unofficial list, and that's the principle of hope. We get honest, and that automatically makes us a little more hopeful, doesn't it? Because lies got our lives in such a mess. But it's hard to keep up with lying. Very difficult. And so the fact that we move on into step two and put there some hope. Hope is something, a principle that you're going to need the rest of your life, all of us. Because we're going to go through a lot of ups and downs. There's a jungle out there. We can create a jungle within our own, right in our own little orbit. And we need that hope. And that's what step two does for us. Step three, our principle is faith. You know, I often talk with my girls about one of our big nemeses, and that's fear. And all fear is having faith in something that you don't want to happen. So the more faith we can put into our lives, the less fear is going to be there. Because we're not going to be always walking around worrying about something that might happen and that we don't want to happen. We can listen to other people and listen to their stories of how they weathered the storms that are going to come. All kinds. And we listen at meetings. And we see the pain lessen as people grow in this program. And it begins to give us that kind of faith by watching other people. We don't always have to experience the same depth of pain. We can learn from our fellow alcoholics. We can watch them walk through. Through the years, I have watched my beautiful AA friends walk through storms that would throw just a plain old ordinary person, no matter how good and how strong they were. But somehow that faith had been in their life long enough for them to know that everything was going to be okay. So this is where we put our principle of faith, start in on it, and then start using it in all of our affairs. Our fear will lessen. Step three, Satan made us a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. When I read that step and when I first started trying to get into it, and when I talk to my girls now, and so many of them will say, you know, I just can't take step three. I just can't do that. And really, when Bill breaks it down for us the way he does and explains to us what really he's asking, what the program's asking of us, is that we turn our will and our lives. I was willing to turn my life over because I had no trouble. I had been brought up in the very strict German Lutheran church there at home. I had studied catechism for 2 years, and then they take you down the aisle on Palm Sunday and ask you a bunch of questions, and if you know enough about the church, you're allowed to become a member. And if you don't, you go back and study some more. I knew a lot about God, but it took this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it that walked the path ahead of me to teach me to know God. And there's a lot of difference between knowing about something and really knowing Him. So this is one of the things that I was willing to turn my life over to God. But I didn't realize that that was a sort of a piece of cake up against turning my will over to Him. That was where the hard part came in. I love the way that Bill starts here, because it gives us another idea that this is a lifetime project, because it is a way of life. He says, practicing step 3 is like the opening of a door which to all appearances is still closed and locked. And notice he said practicing. He didn't say perfecting step 3. My girls will tell me, you know, I just can't do step 3. Well, I always say, honey, you're not supposed to do it. You're supposed to start in and start practicing turning this will and this life. It very, very few people have I ever heard that could do it in a split second. And he's suggesting here, by using that as the first word in the step, practicing. And just the act of practicing is like opening that door. All we need is a key and the decision to swing the door open. There is only one key, and it's called willingness. Once unlocked by the willingness to give it a go, the door opens almost by itself. And looking through it, we shall see a pathway beside which is an inscription, and it reads, "This is the way to a faith that works." There's a promise. This is it. This is the way to a faith that works. In the first 2 steps, we were engaged in reflection. We saw that we were powerless over alcohol, but we also perceived that faith of some kind, if only in AA itself, is possible to anyone. These conclusions did not require action. They required only acceptance. We had been looking back. Now we can look forward, and we know by watching the people in AA, from that beautiful man Wesley sitting up there, I learned so much. By just over the years, watching him practice faith and picking up little clues that he had run across. And the willingness to try. He didn't know whether this thing was going to work or not. It was a tremendous amount of work that first year. And the room was filled to this first door. There was nothing beyond that. Nobody else. Just the first, up to the first door here. He didn't know whether this thing was going to work. But he was willing to try it. And he had enough faith in the program that it would do the selling job itself, that it would do its own work. That's the few that were here that first year would tell another couple and another couple. And here we are, clear back up against the wall, redneck mother back there, and also out on the porch. The willingness to try, because if we talked over and over about this is not all about drinking. This is about living. The willingness to give a new idea a try. These conclusions, once again, did not require action. They required only acceptance, the concluding that I am going to give this thing a try. And acceptance is part of that growing of faith. Those of you who know me know how I love the little story that was passed on to me when I was down in Alabama early on in my sobriety. And a little fella passed on a story that goes around AA, but those of you that are new might not have heard it, that I think is a beautiful example of acceptance. And that was when they brought in these first great big old 18-wheelers for these men to drive. And it was about the time that they were beginning to think about, you know, mind games and all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't good enough to see if these boys could back these things into a small space, if they could really handle that much weight out on the road. So they decided that the driver test was not enough, that they would give these boys, before they gave them the license to drive the big 18-wheelers, they'd give them a little test, psychological. And so after he got through with his test, his driving test out on the road, they brought him into a little room, this little fellow, and they gave him a hypothetical situation. They said, now, if you're coming down a steep, steep hill, and it's raining and it's slick, and there's a curve right down there at the bottom of that hill, and you get down there almost to it, and you find out you don't have any brakes, what you gonna do? And the old boy sat there a minute, and he said, well, I think I'll wake up Leroy. Well, now, you know how these therapists are. He wanted him to put it into his own words. He thought that was, now, that's compassion. He's going to wake up his helper. But he wanted to put it into your own words. So he said, well, why would you wake up Leroy? And he said, well, Leroy, he ain't never seen a great big wreck. That's acceptance, folks. And that's really, we talked about complicating things this morning. That's really how, you know, what else was there? That was a fact. You know, sometimes we have to be awfully careful not to confuse the facts of life with the acts of God. We get them all confused. But just to know that that was the real alternative there, to merely accept the fact, even if we have to just believe that that faith will come by watching other people practice it in our groups. That's a beginning. It says, like all the remaining steps, step 3 calls for affirmative action. For it is only by action that we can cut away that self-will which has always blocked an entry of God, or, if you like, a higher power, into our lives. Faith, to be sure, is necessary, but faith alone can avail nothing. We can have faith, yet keep God out of our lives. Therefore, our problem now becomes just how and by what specific means shall we be able to let him in. Step 3 represents our first attempt to do this, our very first run and go at it. In fact, here's a promise. Look at it. In fact, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. Doesn't say anything about our sobriety there, because a lot of people go along dry and sober. But he's talking about, you know, the effectiveness of this whole program into our lives that we can carry to our graves. Rest upon how well and earnestly we've tried to do this. So see, that's all we have to keep doing. If you're hung up on that step 3, or if you're working with somebody that's hung up on it, just keep using that word, try it. Try it out every day. Get up in the morning and say, I'm gonna try to turn my will and my life over to care to God today. And just not worry about things that haven't happened yet, that might happen, that could happen. We had a series of idiot tornadoes last week in my part of Texas. Well, an idiot tornado tore up my house in 1983, 2 weeks before the seminar, the very first one we held here. It redecorated my house. I had a tree in my living room. Beautiful contemporary look. but without a roof, it was a little wet. But, you know, if we sit around, it's tornado season down there. And if we sit around every time they say that there's going to be a tornado and just know that there's going to be one, that sucker will turn and go in this other direction. And we've wasted all that time worrying about it. And besides that, we can't do anything if we see one coming anyhow. Because I've never seen anybody outrun one. Old Mark Twain wasn't so dumb when he said, you know, half of the things we worry about never happen. And I also advise my girls sometime when they call and they're crying and they're desperate about a situation that, you know, they just know this is going to happen. And I ask them, just write it down on a little old piece of paper, take it into the bedroom and put it in the bottom of a dresser drawer someplace. And then in a week, let's take it out and look at it. And half the time it hadn't happened. And it's a good little experiment to run. We can just be worried to death about something. Just know that that's the way it's going to turn out. And a week later, you'll see the time that you wasted, that valuable time, the one thing money can't buy, that time. And we see how much we waste by worrying about something that hadn't even happened yet. So if we give this a try, even suggesting to the new people, just today, try, instead of getting all into a swivet about something, just say, you know, it's gonna work out somehow. I don't know. I'm going to do everything I'm supposed to do. But it'll work out. I might not agree with the way it worked out, but if I'm going to turn my life and my will over to the care of God, I'm going to figure that He knows what's better for me than I do. And you know, that's the way it's turned out so many times during these years. I thought I'd have, you know, everything all figured out just the way I wanted it to happen. My higher power went in the opposite direction. But see, I'm still here. Still here. And having that faith that it's going to work out one way or the other, and that I'll survive any way that it happens to work out. It says, to every worldly and practical-minded beginner, this step looks hard, even impossible, page 35. No matter how much one wishes to try, exactly how can he turn his own will and his own life over to the care of whatever God he thinks there is? Fortunately, we who have tried it, and with equal misgivings, can testify that anyone at all, can begin to do it. We can further add that a beginning, even the smallest, is all that's needed. Once we have placed the key of willingness in the lock and have the door ever so slightly open, we find that we can always open it a little bit more. And now look at that next little tiny sentence. Though self-will may slam it shut again, as it frequently does, it'll always respond the moment we again pick up the key of willingness. So it tells us that, sure, every once in a while that self-will's going to rear its ugly head and we're going to headlong into an obstacle, just even if it's butting our heads up against a stone wall. And I've heard people at meetings say, you know, I have so much trouble with step three because I turn my life and my will over to care of God, and then I take it back, and then I try to give it to Him again, and I keep taking it back. And I say, well, let's see what it says on page 35 of the 12 and 12. It says that we're likely to do this, that even if we've made that little beginning, that self-will is going to slam that door shut again. And the big thing with me, I had to practice saying to myself, now wait a minute, Willie, and I've heard it around meetings so many times, my program is it just doesn't seem to be working. And we lose a little bit of faith in the AA program. Each time we have taken something over and it didn't turn out, we take that self-will back and it didn't turn out right, and we think there's something wrong with our program. No, it's a human trait to reach out and say, I know this is the best way to do this. And if I do certain things, then such and so will happen. And we don't even consult anybody about it. We just do it. That's because we're human beings, once again, just like Dr. Silkworth said we are. Maybe this all sounds mysterious and remote, something like Einstein's theory of relativity or a proposition in nuclear physics. It isn't at all. Let's look at how practical it actually is. Every man and woman who has joined AA and intends to stick has, without realizing it, made a beginning on step 3. So see, even if you've been plundering around with it and thinking that you haven't done it, you're here this weekend, aren't you? There are other things you could be doing, but you're here. So even though you're, you know, saying that you haven't made even a beginning on step 3, you have. Isn't it true that in all matters touching upon alcohol, each of them have decided to turn his and her life over to the care, protection, and guidance of Alcoholics Anonymous? There's no other reason for us to be here this weekend, except a renewal of that faith that we found in this program. Already a willingness has been achieved to cast out our one's own will and our own ideas about the alcohol problem in favor of those suggested by AA. Any willing newcomer feels sure that AA is the only safe harbor for the foundering vessel that he has become, even if he's coming back and not even liking it, sitting there hating every minute of it, because that's what I did. I presented myself after I finally did take my last drink in Seattle, Washington. For the next couple of years, I sat around in AA meetings. And I was there, but I'll be dead-gummed if I was going to be joyous and free. And I wasn't going to, you know, give any of this smile, happy face around any place. This is the way I was angry about it. And we see our newcomers, a lot of times they're coming to meetings. But just the fact that they're coming, see, isn't it odd? I kept going and there wasn't anybody pushing me then. The pushing had stopped. It was my call. Now, if this isn't turning one's will and life over to a newfound providence, then what is it? But suppose that instinct still cries out, as it certainly will. Yeah, respecting alcohol, I guess I have to be dependent upon AA. But in all other matters, I must still maintain my independence. Nothing is going to turn me into a non-entity. Don't you love that? So many of us had that thought. Nothing is going to turn me into a non-entity. What did I think I was when I got to y'all? A great success in life? When I first read that, I thought, well, how ridiculous it was, because I did. You can't tell me how to live. I'll come to your dumb meetings, but you're not going to tell me how to live. I'll turn into, you know, just a sponge, not a big nothing. And that's what I already was a big nothing, because that's what alcohol had done to me. Crazy. You know, we think these kind of things. If I keep on turning my life and my will over to the care of something or somebody else, what'll become of me? I'll look like the hole in a donut. And I don't know anything more that I resembled when I got to you than a hole in a donut. Because there wasn't anything there. There was no substance. There was no happiness. There was no dignity. That described me pretty well. But see, I wasn't going to let y'all do anything to me to make me into that non-entity by telling me how I should live my life. This, of course, is the process by which instinct and logic always seeks to bolster egotism and so frustrate spiritual development. The trouble is that this kind of thinking takes no real account of the facts. And the facts seem to be these. The more we become willing to depend upon a higher power, the more independent we actually are. Man, that was astounding when I started realizing that I had more freedom, that I wasn't dependent upon people as I had been when I was drinking. Therefore, dependence, as AA practices it, is really a means of getting true independence of the spirit. And by spirit, that's the way down deep inside of us. That with this willingness to have that faith in our life and to keep giving it that try, we can do so many things that I thought it would rob me of all my independence. And I had actually gotten to the point where I wasn't doing, you know, us drunks, some of us don't do very much when we get to drinking. And I think that's might be a little bit truer with women. So many of us go in our houses and we shut our doors and we draw our drapes and we drink. It's a lonely, lonely world, isn't it? Even in this modern swinging age, there's a lot of us that do our drinking right in our own four walls. We don't hit bars and get out and stir it up. And see, I'm of the nature, it was my nature before alcohol got a hold of me and I crossed that invisible line, it was my nature to be adventuresome. I was in for everything. I always loved to be right smack dab in the middle of it. As I told y'all this morning, I'm not the shy, retiring type, never have been. I'm always, you know, I don't want to sit quietly in a corner someplace. I'm one of these that likes to, you know, put on the war paint and go raid the village. But after that alcohol got a grip on me, it robbed me of my independence to do all of these crazy things that I wanted to do. New things that I wanted to do. And by practicing turning my will and my life over to the care of God made me actually more independent. And it's very, very hard to swallow that in the beginning. It's like my son was about 9 or 10 and the little mini bikes were just coming in. And I had been sober a good while then. I had been sober when he was around that age. I'd been sober about 11 years. And he had interest in little mini bikes, so I bought him one. A little Honda 50. And he enjoyed it, riding it, and he took good care of it. He was careful. And so I bought him the 100, went on up to the 150, gradually got the bigger bikes. And when he got up to that 350... I would ride on the back with him a lot. And I had always been fascinated with motorcycles. And I enjoyed riding on the back with him. And we'd tear all over the neighborhood. Turned into the driveway one afternoon. And I said, "Honey, would it embarrass you if I bought me a bike?" "Oh, no, Mother, buy it." So I did. I love that motorcycle. I love riding a motorcycle. I'm still riding a motorcycle. And I love every minute of it. I often laugh when I pull out of the driveway on my motor and I think to myself that my neighbors rather stayed and you know. I know that there's a couple of them might be saying that old broad is too old to be out there riding on that motorcycle. Well, who says? You know, who says? I enjoy it. I love it. I love the freedom that he... Could I do that if I was still sucking on a bottle? No. I've been able to ride with my son. That gave us a closeness that we still have. He lives down in Victoria, Texas, a couple of hours away from me. And sometime we meet in the middle, as the country western song says. We decide on a place to meet, and he rides his Honda up as far, and I go ride mine down, and we meet. Sometime just have lunch. He'll tear out for Victoria, and I'll go on back to Spring. And I thought this way of life was going to make me dependent. It gives that freedom to enjoy life by knowing that I'm not in complete control. I do the footwork, and I leave the rest up to God. When my will gets to going, and it does sometime, it wants to take over. When you walk through a trial in life, of course, there's everything in you cries out, I will not have this happen. It will not happen. And it's okay to do that. But then to immediately think, maybe, wait a minute. Maybe I don't understand God's will for me. Let it happen, Willie. You've done everything you possibly can in an earthly way. So let it go. And it's such a good, comfortable feeling, because then you're truly independent. On top of page 37, it says, but the moment our mental or emotional independence is in question, how differently we behave, how persistently we claim the right to decide all by ourselves just what we shall think and just how we shall act. Oh, yeah. We'll weigh the pros and cons of every problem. We'll listen politely to those who would advise us, but all the decisions are to be ours alone. Nobody is going to meddle with my personal independence in such matters. Besides, we think, there's no one we can surely trust. Now, if that isn't a superego, I don't know what I was experiencing, but that's exactly what I thought. I can't trust these people. I can't trust this program. That's super egotism. We're certain that our intelligence, backed with willpower, can rightly control our inner lives and guarantee us success in the world we live in. This brave philosophy, wherein each man plays God, sounds good in the speaking, but it still has to meet the acid test. How well does it actually work? One good look in the mirror ought to be answer enough for any alcoholic. See, it's very hard sometimes to be grateful in a lifetime. As you go along in the storms and the tornadoes and the furor and the panic and everything strikes and the trial and giving up loved ones and the things that are going to happen in our lifetime, it's very hard sometimes to just let that faith be there and that willingness to let go and let God. But trying to do it and trying to will something takes something out of us. It takes an ingredient out of us, and all we need to do is look in that mirror and see that dull look that we have in our eye. Watch that shining look. God, that shining look of somebody that lives this program. I pay a lot of attention to people's eyes. I love you gals' eyes as I look out. I wish I could see all the way back there in the back, because I love to watch your eyes. And that's one of the first things I look at when girls come in to the program. And you fellows too. There's men here that I met in 83 and 84 and 85, and their eyes are so different now. They look a lot better all over. They were brand new to the program. But God, those eyes look like they've gotten a new set. A whole new set. And it's that shining faith that's coming through. On page 40, says, then it's explained that other steps of the AA program can be practiced with success only when step three is given a determined and persistent trial. There we are again. Not when it has been taken 100% and that we know absolutely that we'll never reach out and try to use that willpower again and try to take our lives back. But the rest of the program is dependent upon how well determined and a persistent trial we give this over and over and over. This statement may surprise newcomers who have experienced nothing but constant deflation and a growing conviction that human will is of no value whatever. Those that just give up. In all the years that I taught, I had kids that would get into high school, they'd make it that far, and then they would simply give up. With a constant deflation, or even sometime when they were backed up, but there was a certain something in them that just gave up. They weren't doing A and B and even C. And I would try to tell them, you know, D's will get you through. You'll get that high school diploma. You ride through with the low C's and high D's, you'll make it. And in your particular case, were you interested in being on the honor roll? And most of the time they weren't. But they were giving it everything they had and they weren't successful. In other people's opinion, it always wasn't their parents. Sometimes their parents were telling them the same thing that I was telling them. Keep on trying. Just get through. Get that piece of paper. Doesn't make any difference whether it's scattered with C's. I have some on my high school and all my college transcripts too. Some of the classes I just didn't think were interesting enough to go to. There's some C's sprinkling around, and there's even, you know, a couple of D's. But the thing of it is, I have never, and I have taught in 12 different states in the United States, in Japan, in England, I have never once had a interviewing superintendent that took my transcript and looked at my grades. Never have had one comment. If they noticed I had some C's and D's, they didn't comment. I had the degree, and that's all they were interested in, because that's all they were required to do, was to get the teacher that had the degree that could teach in whatever they wanted them to teach in. I'm not advising any of you young students to, you know, just shoot for D's. I'm talking about... See, I'm also a mind reader, fellas back there in the back. I think you know what I'm talking about. Kids that just, they have so much other stuff going in their lives. They have a lot of other things now. And it's a constant deflation for them to work as hard as they possibly can. They're good average students, but nowadays, sometimes that isn't good enough. In their eyes, not necessarily parents or anybody else. But it's not good enough. They should be doing better. And that constant deflation will wear them down. And what do? They give up. A lot of kids will just give up then rather than to go ahead and face not being able to graduate, not being able to pass that course. That's why I've encouraged them. If you can just squeak out that C-, you're going to make it. But this constant deflation is wearing. In the middle of the paragraph said, they have become persuaded, and rightly so, that many problems besides alcohol will not yield to a headlong assault powered by the individual alone. But now it appears that there are certain things which only the individual can do. All by himself, and in the light of his own circumstances, he needs to develop the quality of willingness. I will give it everything I have. What a beautiful principle to put into your life and try in all of your affairs. Your marrying, your parenting, your job. I've had jobs I did not like. I've had to work under principles I didn't really care for. You noticed I chose that very carefully, didn't you? And it was so good that I'd just say, you know, I'll wear him down before he wears me down. And to go ahead and give it a try. But that headlong is not the way to assault a problem. When you acquire that willingness, he is the only one who can make the decision to exert himself. And we have to sometime to get through problems. We have to get out and do some footwork. And that's not using our own will, it's just doing away with laziness. Trying to do this is an act of his own will. So see, having your own will is not a dirty word. It's when you use it to a good cause. The will to exert yourself enough to get something done, instead of, I've gotten accustomed to saying, you know, tomorrow I'm going to clean the house. And the next day, tomorrow I'm going to clean the house. And it was more closets than houses. You know, us gals know about closets. We going to clean those closets one of these days. And you just keep, you know, walking to it and taking one look at it and closing that door. And you know, maybe it'd take us an hour to really just get in there and throw everything out and start all over again and throw the stuff away that's gotten in there from, you know, company coming, let's put everything in the closet. It maybe take an hour or 2 hours. But no, we close that door. But here's the thing about us gals. We worry about it. Every time we pass that closet, it worries us. And we stew and we and it'll carry on, you know, and our husbands will come home from work and say, well, how was your day? And we'll look down, well, what do you mean by that? We'll reach out and grab anybody. If we worked ourselves up over one simple, dumb, disorganized closet. And we can take so many of the situations in our lives and equate them. Just jump in and do it, willing to exert ourselves to get it done. All of the 12 steps require sustained and persistent exertion to conform to their principles, and so we trust to God's will. If I try every day to be as honest as I possibly can, to accept whatever comes along that I can't do anything about, if I practice that constantly, there's no way that I can't become, you know, a tool that can be used by God. If I'm trying to do the things that he wants his human beings to do, then there's no way that I can get out of God's will in too far a direction, too far out in left field. It's when we try to make our will conform with God's that we begin to use it rightly. Instinctively, we know that God wants us to be honest. He doesn't want us to be angry all the time. He doesn't want us to be envious or jealous. He doesn't want any of these things. We know what he expects of us. Instinctively, we know that. And if we just try each day to conform to that very basic group of principles that we know that's the right way to live. To get rid of that anger. Don't, you know, it can come in and ruin the whole day. we'll talk about that in step four in the morning. But to sidestep these things, each and every day we'll see our lives start conforming to God's will, because that's all He wants for us. I don't think He really expects us to be paragons of virtue. Now, wouldn't that be a mess if we all were going to turn into little saints, you know, with little halos running over? You know, the only thing that scares me about getting that halo is there's only 6 inches between a halo and a noose. And so I'm always afraid to put that sucker up there. I don't think that's what God intends for us. Just good folks. Just good, decent folks. And if we practice these things in all of our affairs to the best of our abilities, we can't help but get a little bit better at living and make other people around us in our little orbit have a better way of life. It's when we try to conform our will to God's that we begin to use it rightly. To all of us, this was a most wonderful revelation. Our whole trouble had been the misuse of willpower. It hadn't been willpower. It had been the misuse of it. We had tried to bombard our problems with it instead of attempting to bring it into agreement with God's intention for us. When I get in the midst of a storm and I say, you know, what would God want me to do? When I really want to blast somebody, I mean, I want to tell them every way but Sunday. I want to be sure they know how I feel about something. If I just stop one moment, if I just think to myself, and I can't, I'm not saying I always do this, but if I just stop and think one moment, now wait a minute, is that your will acting or is it God's will? Does He really want you to hurt this person? Does He really want you to hurt them? Maybe takes away some of their self-confidence? Or it get into their lives at all? What business am I in somebody else's life? And if I really, it doesn't take long analyzation. You automatically, most of us, know the right thing to do. And most of the time it's, Willie, shut up. To make this increasingly possible is the purpose of AA's 12 steps, and step 3 opens the door to take that will and let it conform with God's will, and we know what that is. Once we have come into agreement with these ideas, it's really easy to begin the practice. There's the word practice again. Step 3. In all times of emotional disturbance, of indecision, we can pause, ask for quiet, and in the stillness simply say, God, grant me that serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and that wisdom to know the difference. In all quietness, we can do that. It doesn't take but a split second. And that automatic instinct will kick in and we'll know what to do. Rather to get away from a situation, step back and get away from it, to shut our mouths and to watch our actions and our thoughts. There's a beautiful little, and I know many of you that are older in AA have run across it, but maybe some of the newcomers haven't. And it's not improving on the serenity prayer. It's doing sort of like the 12 and 12 does with our blessed textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just sort of a little in-depth look and gives us a little more perspective. I liked it when I ran across it. It takes the serenity prayer and divides it into the little 3 categories. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. That's merely another way of saying to be aware that the irritations and the disappointments of each day are not a perverse plot aimed at me by the world. To understand that this world is not operated for my benefit. That my importance and its debt to me exist in direct ratio to my contributions and my adjustments to it. The courage to things that I can change those things. To eliminate from my environment and its association things I know to be harmful. Attitudes that I know to be insupportable. And no matter how well I thought I argued them, reasons which have no logic. When I'm really trying to explain to you why I did what I did, it doesn't have any logic at all. I did it before I thought about what I was doing. And then the wisdom to know the difference, to understand with neither prejudice, self-justification, nor pity, why changes are necessary in your life, and which changes will give you my life meaning without alcohol. And I liked that when I ran across it. I wanted to pass it on to you. Okay, we'll go ahead and break. That'll give us a little breathing time between supper. Maybe somebody can take a nap.